This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today to learn more about healthcare investing. I've got not one, but two great guests on the line today. Barron's healthcare reporter, Josh Nathan-Kazis, and Dr. Uri Geiger, founder and managing partner of Axelmed, a private equity firm specializing in health tech investments. Uri is also the founding partner of Dragon Variation Fund, one of Israel's first hedge funds, and he's a former adjunct professor at the business school at Tel Aviv University, where he lectured on private equity and venture capital. Let's just say he knows the field well. Welcome, Josh and Uri. We've got a lot to talk about today, so let's dive in.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Wonderful. Lauren.
Terrific. So I want to start with a discussion of COVID. It's receding in America at long last. Although, as Josh wrote this week, the so-called Delta variant is popping up elsewhere in the world and causing a lot of concern. And China is also facing some COVID-related lockdowns again. So, Josh, give us the lay of the land, if you would.
Yeah, so very briefly, you know, cases are way down in the U.S. I think it's about 40% in the last 2 weeks, and deaths are down 20%. And those are really good and heartening numbers. Vaccinations are also down, and the White House and the Biden administration are trying to reverse that trend in large part because of what you just mentioned, the so-called Delta variant, which is a variant that is now dominant in the UK. It seems to have had a role in the explosion of cases in India a couple of months ago. And this is a variant that appears to be more transmissible, but fully vaccinated people do seem to be protected against it. So it's less of a threat to the US if vaccinations continue here, but much more of a threat to much of the world that is not yet vaccinated.
Which is much of the world.
Yeah.
Do you have any insight into what's going on in China?
I think there were certain regions that have had a recent outbreak that appeared to be tied to the Delta variant, and they were putting back some of the strict measures that we'd seen last year. And there was some reporting on that over the weekend. I'm not sure how that's going. You know, they're having widespread mandatory testing and some airports were shut down, but it was pretty localized as far as I understood.
Let's hope it stays so. But interestingly, the biggest healthcare news of the week was not about COVID, but Alzheimer's and the FDA's decision on Monday to greenlight Biogen's Alzheimer's drug, now called Aduhelm. It's a controversial decision. There are questions about whether the drug actually works, and it's rather expensive. But there's no disputing that it's been an enormous benefit to Biogen's shares. The ticker, for those keeping track, is BIIB. The stock is up almost 50% since the announcement, and it's also been quite beneficial to the shares of other biotech and pharma companies. What does this approval mean for Biogen, Josh? And what does it mean for the rest of the industry? And I can't help but asking, is the good news in the stock?
Well, I think what's happened here is that the FDA has moved the goalpost, right? I mean, I think up until Monday, what we thought was that in order to get an Alzheimer's drug approved, you needed to show that it had an impact on clinical decline, basically that it helped patients in a clear way. What the FDA did on Monday was say, aducanumab, which is now known as Aduhelm, clearly, you know, has a significant impact on the buildup of these sort of junk proteins called amyloid plaque in the brain. And the FDA believes that that is correlated with, slowing cognitive decline. Now, that correlation is controversial and is not accepted by the whole medical community. And I think many will say it's not fully proven. The FDA has required Biogen to do another study to fully, you know, prove that this drug works, but they have quite a long time to get that study done. And in the meantime, this is set to become an enormous blockbuster. Peak sales estimates are all over the place, but they range from $5 billion to $10 billion. And I think there's a lot of people who argue that those are conservative because the FDA has given an enormously broad label to this drug. It's not as though it's been tested only in certain categories of Alzheimer's patients, but they've basically, at least under the broadest reading of the label, said that any Alzheimer's patient can get it. I don't know if that'll happen. There's lots of insurers and payers who will have a say here. But it is an enormous moment in, you know, the history of biopharma, I think. And the implications, as you say, are not just for Biogen. There are a lot of other companies that have drugs that have been, that can very clearly reduce amyloid plaque. They have not been proven to very clearly, you know, induce cognitive benefit or reduce the cognitive decline rather in patients. But there are, you know, a handful of other drugs out there that do seem to have a pretty significant amyloid plaque buildup. Drugs from Lilly, drugs from Roche. The main one that people talk about is a drug called donanemab that we spoke about a number of months ago from Lilly. You know, I think the company had said they would need to finish a second large-scale trial of donanemab before they go to the FDA for approval, but not totally clear they'll need to do that anymore. Lilly is up, I want to say 10%. This week, maybe more. I haven't looked in the past few couple hours, but it's a pretty big major story. As for whether, you know, there's farther for Biogen to climb, and we can talk about this later, but there's a number of other major catalysts on other drugs coming up for Biogen in the next couple of weeks. And I think that those will have a more dramatic impact in the near term than, you know, additional moves related to aducanumab.
Interesting. Uri, I know that you've done some work in the Alzheimer's area as well, and you have some strong thoughts about the FDA's approval. Give us your insights here.
Okay. First, I like to start always by saying I do not do drugs. I'm a medtech or health tech specialist. I do not do drugs. So I'm not an expert in pharmaceutical. But certainly, Alzheimer's disease has been a focus for anyone in the industry. That's an area where anything that works will help many patients. And we are doing some work in neurostimulation to treat the cognitive disorders, including Alzheimer's disease. Specifically on this approval, I think Josh correctly captured that. I think the data about the real patient benefit is very weak. As we know, the drug has been discontinued by the company in 2019. The panel was negative on that. FDA, probably due to pressure by families and societies, has decided to approve the drugs because there is nothing else. And for those patients, and I had my mother-in-law had it, and I can see how the patient and the families suffer, it gives some hope. I doubt it will give any cure, but hope is also has value. So hopefully this hope will help the families at least believe that they are doing the best for their loved one.
All right. Josh, you mentioned it was a landmark in the industry. So I'm curious, what are the next big things that you're watching for and that investors ought to be watching for?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of big catalysts coming up. You know, I think one that we may have mentioned before, a company called Sage is partnered actually with Biogen on a depression drug. And that depression drug has failed in previous trials. They have a big new trial that should offer data by the end of this month. And if it's positive, it would be, you know, a dramatic moment both for Sage shares and for Biogen shares. And I think, you know, potentially the sort of mood of the whole sector. The other one is Vertex. This is a company we've talked about before. Vertex shares dropped pretty dramatically last October because a trial in a rare disease called AATD failed. They're testing a different drug in AATD. And that one is meant to read out any day now. It sort of speaks to the future of Vertex and whether this company, which has really transformed cystic fibrosis over the last number of years, is now ready to move beyond cystic fibrosis to its next big thing. And so I think those are the two big stories that we're waiting on by the end of the month.
Okay, so that is Vertex and Biogen's, I guess, venture with Sage.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. So, Uri, I love that you said you don't do drugs. We'll hold you to that, but... You definitely do health tech, And I'd like to now talk a little bit about the health tech market. How big is this market and what attracts you to it? What kind of opportunities do you see?
So health tech is quite significant markets. It's about $700 billion today, and it's growing significantly. It's encompassed both medical device, diagnostic, including precision medicine, digital health, and technology-driven healthcare services. Overall, it's over $700 billion and growing. So it's a big market. It's not as big as pharmaceutical, but it's certainly large enough. And what attracted me to this market is that it's helped solve many of the problems that we see today of aging population, increasing chronic disease, and rising healthcare cost. Using technology enable us to develop drug faster. It's enable us to keep patients at home and monitor them. It's enable patients to be first informed about their choices, but also improve their own health. Look at companies like Livongo and others that using a lot of big data and patient communication in order to improve the diabetic weight loss, and now other companies coming with mental disorders and others, and all is based around technologies that hasn't been enriched in the past. So this area has been a traditional medtech in the past, but today the interaction between advanced technologies, digital, and new and healthcare is becoming more evident and in everyday life.
Can you give us some examples of the application of AI and big data and other technologies to the field, and tell us about some companies that you find particularly exciting?
Yes. So first, big data, it's a word that in AI probably are used too much by many, because there is difference. You know, there is a lot of hype around it, and we need to find exactly where it can be used. But certainly the ability to analyze a lot of clinical data from many data points and genomics data, biomarkers, clinical personal clinical data of personal files of patients that has been accumulating in countries like Israel, where I originally come from. That's from the 90s. Everybody have their own medical, digital medical record going with them. That's enable us to collect the data and to tailor specific treatment to the specific patient. The use of AI enable us to improve imaging diagnostics, pathology, genomics companies like Foundation, Grail, a Semaphore that was a spin-off from Mount Sinai, and I think is now being SPAC'd, has been capturing this data for some time and using it for much better diagnostic and faster drug development.
So that's very interesting, and I agree with you that the phrases are a bit overused. So you mentioned Israel, and you really had a front row seat to the rise of Israel as the original startup nation. And I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about the healthcare and the health tech landscape in Israel, which companies you're watching and which technologies look most promising to you there.
So I think Israel is unique in some perspective. First, it's a very efficient healthcare system, I think, and that's something that the U.S. healthcare system is, in my view, unfortunately sick. It's chronically sick, mainly driven by inefficient payer system. Any person is usually getting his medical insurance through the employer, and on average, a patient stay or about 3 years in one plan before he moves through election or move another employer. So there is no investment or no incentive to invest in developing and preventing disease and keeping the wellness of the patients. Furthermore, when you grow up and go into Medicare by law is prohibited from providing any reimbursement for preventive medicine. You can provide reimbursement to treat the disease, but you cannot provide reimbursement to prevent it. So overall, the system from from the base to the end is sick. In Israel, it's very different. It's there are basically three or four HMOs. You get since you're a child until you die, you are staying with the same HMO. You have your digital file. The HMO get from the government a certain amount to keep you healthy, and they need to keep you healthy or they have loss. So basically they're doing their best. And the result is that using a lot of technology, as mentioned, digital health record, AI, enable Israel to be at the top five in term in any healthcare measurement of life expectancy and deaths and births, much, much better than the U.S., at about 20% of the cost. So I think that the first fundamental is a difference in the holistic view on healthcare, whether it's fragmented like in the U.S. and or whether it's look on patient long-term value like it is in Israel. That's statement number one. Specifically, another thing that make Israel unique is the nature of Israel as a startup nation. As we know, Israel is known as a hub for medical technologies, and we use it as well here. When we operate in the U.S., we usually acquire U.S. commercial companies and later integrate into them Israeli startups that have approved technologies but have no marketing outreach. So in Israel, we find a lot of innovation, but on the other hand, we find a lot of, disabilities in the ability to commercialize this innovation, being so far in the Middle East with no local markets and no less capital and no expertise in commercial management. Israelis are great at innovation, but are doing an average job at best in commercialization.
That's an interesting dilemma.
Yeah. I can give specific name of companies if you like, but I wanted just to make two points about one on the macro, on the healthcare system, and second on the startup nation nature.
I do want to get to some specific companies, but first I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the digital health record that follows you, and that seems to me to be a big area of weakness in the U.S. When you go to a doctor's office, some are digitized and some have walls and walls of paper files about patients.
And that's results that you don't. Yeah, I think that the number one in Israel, because you basically with the same HMO, it's everything on the same computerized system, same database, and that's make everything much more efficient along the way. And that's something that will take time in the U.S. to integrate. There are some systems that are closed systems that keep, you know, the patient basically usually doesn't move, but by large, it's very hard to create such a system unless there is one unified system, unless you get 65 under Medicare and all the claims are centralized. But there are ways at least to mitigate some of that. For example, we recently acquired the control in a company called MedMinder, which is an online pharmacy that have a technology-based service that first centralize all of your medications in one place and have one system that makes sure that there are no drug-drug interaction. But later, through a device in the patient home, make sure that you get the right drug at the right time, follow the adherence and the actual, that the patient is actually taking the drugs in the right time, and make the full connectivity between the patients, their pharmacists, their physician, and the family to one centralized system. So payers are actually moving their more complex patients to this system for external private party to manage it for them. It's great for us because we make money, but overall, it's not a very efficient system.
So what's the trajectory for a company like MedMinder? It's private now. Is it profitable? Is the goal to take it public? Is it to merge it with another company? What's the future for a company like that? It seems like a brilliant idea.
So MedMinder is growing dramatically. It's almost doubling the revenue every year, and we expect to continue to do so. We have just acquired the control in March, and when we get to, you know, a few hundreds of millions of revenues rather than a few dozens, I think that will be a time to potentially take it public. We are trying to penetrate to more states. We now have Massachusetts and New York. We're going into Texas and then to Florida, mainly where we have more elderly population and polypharmacy patients. But yes, the solution would be using technologies in order to make sure that patients get the right drug at the right time, make sure for the adherence, and that results in significant saving in the overall cost of healthcare for those payers that are using this system.
And costs are certainly key. So our audience follows the financial markets, public stocks, private companies, and so forth. And we've all been struck by the enormous amount of money that's flowing into every market and every asset class, courtesy of monetary and fiscal policy here and abroad. And I wonder, what does this mean for the healthcare market? Do you see too much money chasing too few opportunities? Do you see price and value becoming detached from each other? What's the impact of all this capital flow?
Yeah, and you know, I'll probably be too, I'm usually open, even if it's, yes, too much, even if it's worked for me in some cases. We are taking now, I won't name even the sector, because we are taking public companies that have zero revenue for $1 billion valuation. And that's great. And I love the investors that buy the stock, will buy the stock. But eventually, I think that what we see today in public market, it's, as you mentioned, the combination of no alternative and an interest rate that is very low. Again, we just saw inflation starting to rise again. So that may change despite the Federal Reserve policy not to do that. But they will have to rethink if that's continued. And combination with many young guys that trade without really fundamental understanding that the risk involved in that, that results in overflow of capital. And we see a lot of companies that get in capital and get in valuations and multiples that are, to me, doesn't make, I have my PhD from Colombia. I'm a value investor and looking fundamentals. And yes, technology is here to stay. Technology improve processes. And there is reason for premium for good technology. But the multiples we see now in the market and some companies going either public directly or even more through SPACs, eventually will result potentially in some disappointment to many investors.
Well, this is an utterly baffling market, I'd say, to value investors. So
it's
not something value investors are used to. So I want to go back to some of the week's healthcare news with Josh before we get to some excellent listener questions. Josh, Abbott Labs took a hit as sales of its COVID-19 drug are falling. I suppose that's great for the COVID, it's great for humanity, shall we say, that tests are less necessary than they used to be. Not so great for Abbott. What does it mean for the company and its stock?
Yeah, you know, Abbott had developed a number of rapid COVID tests. And, you know, we just don't need as many of those anymore. Abbott was surprised at how quickly the demand fell. Part of what happened is the CDC said, issued new guidance, rather, that suggested that people who have a vaccine or are vaccinated really don't need to get tested virtually at all in most circumstances. So Abbott cut its earnings guidance pretty dramatically. It went from $5 a share for this year down to between $4.30 and $4.50. Not great for Abbott, but pretty good for the world.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of looking at it. So Merck is also back in the COVID discussion after the failure of its COVID vaccine, but it's developing a promising antiviral, which is also putting antivirals back in the news. So tell us more about what's going on there.
Yeah, you know, back at the beginning of COVID, we talked a lot about Gilead's COVID antiviral, which had, you know, I think questionable efficacy. It did seem to shorten the duration of symptoms, but its impact on mortality is still debated. Merck has a separate antiviral they've been working on. This one has a big advantage of actually being an oral antiviral, as opposed to Gilead's, which was intravenous, and to the monoclonal antibody treatments, which are the other sort of main category of treatments for people with COVID, and those are also intravenously administered. This drug is being developed in collaboration with a private firm called Ridgeback Biotherapeutics. And the news here is that the U.S. government said this week, or Merck said this week, that the U.S. government will pay $1.2 billion for a certain number of doses of this drug if it gets emergency use authorization. It could actually end up being a pretty big seller for Merck this year and next if the drug works, but we still don't know if it works. There was a trial of this drug called molnupiravir in hospital.
I love the way these names roll off.
it seemed to not work in hospitalized patients, but they are testing it now in sort of more early stage non-hospitalized patients. And I think there's a hope that it'll prove effective and help people who contract COVID.
Interesting. We'll be watching Merck for sure. So I want to go to some listener questions. Sarosh asks, as a medical student, and I'm so glad we have medical students listening on this call, how would you advise that I get involved in the health tech economy to create a path for future opportunities in the space? And I'll turn that one over to Uri.
Okay, so I'll try. Glad for the question. I think that you can certainly, not only AstraMed, but other funds use medical students as kind of night analysts. And we have a number of medical students that have graduated. Some decided to go into the investment career. By the way, I encourage everybody to first become real physician and work with patients before moving to that. I don't think that just studying medical and running into investment is the best path. But certainly you can apply to some, and you can send me myself later, so LinkedIn, some of the funds will offer medical students opportunity to work and an investment as a night analyst. Not that you don't have enough to do on your day-to-day life, but that's a way to go into that.
Correct. I think they're rather busy, but it's an interesting path.
Yeah.
For sure. We have another question from Adnan. Do you see any changes coming in Medicare from it going more reactive to preventive, as you mentioned earlier, and thus operating potentially more efficiently and cutting costs? Since you touched on that, Uri, what do you think?
So first, I have no insight. There is no current bill that is changing that. Hopefully, at some point, it will. I would tell you that we have tried in the past using some lobbyists and to change that and failed. And so I raise hands. You know, I'm too small and don't have enough money to change the U.S. healthcare system. Actually, the only most recent news I heard from Medicare is that they basically suspended the breakthrough device designation, which was a great hope for new technologies coming into the market. This program that came up with a lot of prize in the past has just been suspended last week. So I haven't heard anything encouraging from Medicare, but hopefully it will come.
What was the reason for the suspension? I think I missed this.
They claim for budgetary restrictions. They couldn't find the budget. As you know, this plan was for novel devices that prevent deaths or save significant cost for significant diseases. They were enabling to get reimbursement for the first few years until more data is collected. The main difference between pharmaceutical and medtech innovation is once you approve as a drug, you're on the orange book, you usually get reimbursement quite fast for a device. It's from approval to reimbursement may take years. And new devices that come in with technology that can help patients were suffering or never commercialized due to this restriction. The breakthrough device designation came in as a together with FDA and CMS initiative and died officially last week.
Well, hopefully we have some philanthropists on the line as well. So I have another question for you, I guess both of you. This is a investment question from Hal. Why have virtual med tech stocks like Teladoc stumbled in recent weeks? Josh, any insights there?
Teladoc's had a hard time. You know, they grew dramatically last year and said on an earnings call earlier this year that they expected very, very little to no membership growth. And then, you know, Amazon also announced not so long ago that it is entering this business. So, Teladoc stock has not had a good couple of months. And I think there's a couple of reasons there. Mm-hmm. And there's more competitors. I mean, it's an incredibly crowded space. And I think that Teladoc has to prove that it can take its sort of first mover status and that's valuable, beyond at this point when Amazon and American Well and all the other firms are jumping in.
Tell us a little more about Amazon's ambitions in healthcare.
Well, Amazon's ambitions are always frightening to everybody in every market that they enter. Most recently they have a new telehealth product called Amazon Care that now has announced a employer customer, you know, it's still not so big, but it's Amazon. So who knows how big it could get.
So I think what you said about first mover advantage, it's an advantage until it's not.
Yeah. And I think the argument against Teladoc is that it's not so hard to, you know, to sort of white label a system like that on your own. But obviously Teladoc has all sorts of arguments why they are set up for success. So it's not something that we can thoroughly explore in the time left, but it is an interesting question.
Yeah, for sure. So last question from listeners, we have a question about managed care stocks and what the outlook is. Do either of you have thoughts on that?
I would just say that, you know, as the pandemic eases in the U.S., healthcare utilization is going to go up, and some managed care companies are better prepared for that than others. There was a note out this morning from an analyst, honestly, I forget which, saying that downgrading Anthem, particularly because they seemed, you know, less well set up to deal with that than, say, United Health or Humana. But it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Or do you see any changes ahead for Medicare Advantage, for instance, our listener asks, with regard to managed care stocks?
So I'm not an expert in this area, so I would like to provide an answer in an area which I'm not the right expert.
Well, I think that's fair. So let me ask you in closing, since we're just about out of time, is there anything I've left out, Uri, that you'd like to share with the audience? Any topic I've missed here?
No, I think that overall we should look more for companies that are trying to solve the problems of the healthcare system, companies that using the interaction directly with the patient and the patient having responsibility on themselves, mainly in chronic disease and chronic conditions. And I mentioned one of them earlier around diabetic and weight management. Because as I don't have a lot of hope for changing the system itself, I think that technology can solve some of the problems, and patient-centric wellness is an area that is going to grow. Another area to focus is chronic care management. More and more patients live longer with chronic disease. In those areas, companies that improve care and save cost will strive.
Thank you so much. It's been a great call, and I really appreciate your participation. And thank you, Josh, for your many insights as well.
I enjoyed it.
I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and we hope you come back tomorrow when Bill Burkhardt, President and COO of the Investment Integration Project, speaks with Penta senior writer Abby Schultz about moving from sustainable investment strategies to systems-like strategies that can tackle broad, complex issues such as income inequality or climate change. So thank you both, and thanks again to our listeners. Stay well, everybody, and have a good day.